Good afternoon. You can choose which of them you prefer to see. This is I'm going to tell you about something about solutions of what algebra equation is and what are something about new solutions which we found to this equation. This is a joint work with Dr. Amir Regev, who is now at the Israel Aerospace Industry, and Professor Yehuda Agnon, who is my good friend and colleague working together at the Faculty of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the Technion in Haifa. I may need this, I'm not sure. Let's put them on. Algebra equation was a pointer there, which is gone by now. Okay, no, there was a pointer with a red dot. What here, yeah. No, never mind. Okay, so we are looking at the top equation, which is the algebra equation for nonlinear random waves, surface waves on the surface of the ocean. Here we have water, and here we have air above, and we talk about waves on the surface of the ocean. We will talk today about unidirectional waves. One can extend some of the things. So the waves propagate in the x direction. And rho, I try to explain what rho is. The best way to understand what rho is to start from the bottom and go upwards. Eta, if this is x and this is z, so eta. So z equal eta of x and t is the time, is the equation of the free surface. So we are thinking about a situation where we have kind of a narrow spectrum, namely that all wave numbers are in a vicinity of a certain wave number k naught, which we call a carrier. This will be the wave carrier. And is the amplitude of modulation. It's a modulation amplitude. K naught is the carrier. Root of GK is the frequency of the carrier. A is actually the quantity for which many people write the cubic Schrödinger equation or the NLS for water waves. Now. Rho is defined of the by the two-point spatial correlation of the wave envelope, where the triangular brackets stand for the ensemble average. So we have many different realizations of this situation, and the R, we take two points along the water surface, one at x plus r over 2, the other one is x minus r over 2. So r is the spacing between these points. So starting from the cubic Schrödinger equation, making some assumptions, some stochastic assumptions, which we will not go right now into them. Alber, who also worked together at the time, there is also a paper by Alber and Safman, back in 1978, derived the above equation. The unknown is rho, as we see, and rho is a function of x r and t. This is closer. It stems from the cubic Schrödinger equation, and it's actually, I would call it, a stochastic generalization of the cubic Schrödinger equation. In this case, for surface gravity waves. By the way, in a homogeneous ocean, or for a homogeneous case, rho does not depend on x, it only depends on the spacing r. And if you go to this equation and you'll see what happens, you will find that any homogeneous rho homogeneous, which is only a function of r, satisfies this equation. So any homogeneous ocean is a solution of this equation. The advantage of this equation that it enables you also to treat non-homogeneous situations. And we will of course concentrate on them. Now, although the paper goes a long time back, there has not been done much work with this. It's cited about something between 20 to 30 times. Half of them in water waves, the rest in some other application of waves. But really working with this equation, you can find something like 2, 3, 4 papers. So somehow this branch has been ignored, and the water wave community went in some other direction, which I'm not going to elaborate about right now because we don't have enough time. What was this? Okay. Here actually a proof, and it's a well-known result that in case of a homogeneous ocean, you have a simple relation between S, the wave number spectrum of the ocean, and rho H, which is the correlation, and you can go both ways back and forth. This transparency, if you look in detail, it tells a lot of things, but we don't have so much time. The question is, if we have the given spectrum S, how do we write a realization of the water surface? Of course, you have to bring a randomness in to get a certain realization. The randomness comes into this problem through theta, which is a random phase in the exponent. Still looking for that, but never mind. Following more or less the work of Albert itself and some other people like Peter Janssen and Ewan and Lake, who have played a little bit with this equation, the first attempt was to see, to study the stability of the homogeneous ocean to inhomogeneous disturbances. I think I would appreciate it. Maybe somebody can ask the lady where she put the, because very difficult not to, I'm not tall enough to, so what we see on the upper line is that we take the rho, the 2-point spatial correlation, to be a sum of a homogeneous situation where rho only depends on r, and the small non-homogeneous disturbance. The smallness is governed by the small parameter delta there. Still, I have to say something about the function rho 1. Thank you. Still, I have to say something about the function rho 1, and the assumption made by Albert himself and also by other people that you can write rho 1 in this form. As a multiplication of two terms. One is a very general function, R of R. R of R does not need a lot of properties. It needs to decay with a large R for a certain rate. It also, I think that R of 0 cannot be 0, but besides that, any R we wish we can put there. Capital K is the wave number disturbance compared to small k, which is the wave number of the original homogeneous wave field. You see that this disturbance moves with the group velocity, and omega, depending on the fact if it's real or imaginary, you will have either stable or unstable situations. So we actually want to specify the homogeneous ocean. We want to choose a certain wave number and look if it is stable or unstable to this kind of that's a standard linear stability analysis for this problem. If you plug the second equation into the first and then together into the original Alber equation, after some cooking, you get this condition for the calculation of omega. This is the one we want to calculate and look at for the stability. Omega is here redefined as gamma, and gamma appears in the equation right here. So you have to solve this equation. To solve it, of course, you have to give the specific spectrum of the homogeneous C that for which you are interested in. I beg your pardon? A capital K is the wave number. We had this. Well, it was here before the talk.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was
the gray one.
Yeah, I didn't see it. Okay, capital K is the wave number of the disturbance. So it comes in here. Little k is the wave number of the homogeneous ocean. K naught, I'm just repeating, K naught is, if you have a narrow spectrum, it will just be, let's say, the middle of the spectrum. Okay. People refer to it also as the carrier wave. People played around with different spectra. You have here a choice. You have a Gaussian spectrum, very popular Lorentz spectrum. They all have equations. I also thought it would be nice to try out a square spectrum. Why not? All the spectra drawn here on this picture have the same energy. So the area under the curve is the same. They also have a comparable width. You can play with the coefficients to give them a comparable width. We will see that the width is very important. The width of the spectrum is narrow, but still it can be narrow, or a little bit wider. It must be narrow because we started from the cubic Schrödinger equation. So we are within the framework of the assumption of that equation. So what we see here are actually the stability diagrams. Let's just look on the lower one. They are for the three different spectra. Let's look on the lower one for the Gaussian spectra. They are plotted in a non-dimensional rectangle. K is the non-dimensional wave number disturbance. You see, related, normalized by the wave number of the carrier and by epsilon, which is a typical steepness of the homogeneous ocean which we had there before. The same way we normalize the width of the spectrum in the same way, and it turns out that the growth rate, which is omega I, the non-dimensional growth rate, needs to be normalized by epsilon square. That's very typical. It's the same time scales that you have in the cubic Schrödinger equation for the evolution. And what you see here, everything which is white is stable. Everything which is within this area is unstable. The isolines with the values on them are values for the growth rate. The dashed line is the line of marginal stability. And the maximum growth rate is here. Has a value about one half. By the way, if you take a W tilde to zero, this will be exactly the case of a single wave, and you're actually studying the Benjamin Fair instability problem. So you actually recover on this axis the values of the Benjamin Fair instability. If instead of a spike, you allow to have a broader spectrum with infinite many spikes, then of course you get different growth rates. The interesting thing is that once you get outside a certain width, things restabilize again. Maybe this is the fact which discouraged people from doing further work, I don't know. But the fact is that when this equation shows you that when you go beyond a certain width, it becomes stable again. Of course, also if you go for certain disturbances right here, but this is very consistent with what we know from the Benjamin Fair stability analysis. Another thing which you see on this diagram are dots. These dots are for the different cases which I'm going to analyze later. There's also a dot here, which didn't come out good on the projector. You see that both C and B are within the stable region, whereas the different A's and D are within the unstable region. In this respect, okay. So far, what I told you is very similar to the original work of Albert. There's nothing new, really, in what I told you. What I want, the intention of the work is to take it further, not just to be satisfied with the linear stability analysis, but to see what is happening with these unstable modes in long time. So actually, to solve the evolution of this. Of this wave field, but before doing so, I would like to. We started out with a certain type of inhomogeneous disturbance. I personally, and assume that quite a few others, don't have good intuition or good feeling about the two-point correlation. You can write it, but you really don't get a feeling what is going on. At least in engineering, the spectrum of the ocean is a tradable commodity. People talk about it, they understand what it means and so on. So what I've tried to do is to represent the initial condition in a spectral form. I don't go through the details, I just show the results. And the results look something like this. I'm speaking about the initial conditions in a spectral presentation. This is the spectrum, which consists of, from the homogeneous spectrum, we drew here a Gaussian, and the sideband disturbances are represented by these two small humps on both sides. You have a sideband disturbance at the right and the side. Now, the disturbance here was also chosen to be Gaussian, but you can choose other disturbances, and I show you also results with other disturbances. The important thing is there is some analogy in the Benjamin Fair instability. We speak about a mode and two sidebands, and we study the instability of this system. Is a sideband instability. Here, the stochastic cousin has, instead of a mode, a spectrum, and has two, I would call, sideband spectra, but they are not so simple, at least in the example that we are talking about. Usually, in a spectrum, any K that you will choose will have its own random frequency. So it will be kind of a random frequency approach. Here the situation is not like this. The point AR has the, sorry, I said frequency, I want to say phase. I correct myself. Each mode has its own random phase. If you look on these two sideband disturbances, the interesting thing is that the mode here has the same phase as the mode A here. A right is the same phase, must have the same phase as this, and A left has also the same phase. So all three of them have the same phase. CL, C, and CR both shifted to the same amount from the center, must have the same phases. So this, it's clear that you need a phase, these phases to be related to each other, because this makes for the inhomogeneity. If all the phases were completely random, you are back to an homogeneous situation. So if you want to add a non-homogeneous disturbance, you have to add something which can be any disturbance you like, but the phases need to be in some sense correlated. Otherwise it will be... So I think Albert didn't knew it, that what he chose, and many after him, was actually choosing things like this, where you have this type of phase correlation. Okay, having told this, I'm now going into the into the long time evolution. For this, I have to solve the Albert's equation numerically. This is the domain of solution. X, where we have the disturbance with wave number capital K. So the initial condition is periodic in X. We assume this periodicity to be maintained in all time. This is the X axis. This is the non-dimensional X. It's more than X. It's actually moving with the group velocity. There are a lot of small technicalities here, but it's basically, one can think about it as X. The R direction, in principle, R goes from zero to, from minus infinity to plus infinity. There's some symmetry, so it's enough to draw from zero to infinity. Of course, numerically, I have to cut it somewhere. So we have some R here, which we call R end. And the question is, are we cutting it in the correct way? And that's not the only thing. What is the condition to put here at R infinity? My guess is many people who try to, if people have tried to solve this, to integrate the Albert equation numerically, what discouraged them, which get them into messy results, is the condition at here. If you just put a zero after a certain time, you get garbage. So you need to be smarter with the condition here. So I'm solving the problem in this rectangle, and time goes upwards. Tau is the non-dimensional time. So we give initial conditions here, and we go up in time. Boundary condition, I already told you. Periodicity in X. This is the special condition which I've applied in large R. I can talk about it a little bit more if you will be specially interested at the end. This stabilized everything. We checked, of course, and now what you see here, dead. No. What you see here is this is time. This is non-dimensional time. And you see here rho at R equals zero, the maximum value. The maximum value is usually at the edges, either at X equals zero or at X equal, or at C equal pi. This is the periodicity. And first of all, you already get the feeling that something, that you get the recurrence. Very similar to what you get When you solve the cubic Schrödinger equation, you get what is called Fermi-Pasta-Ulam recurrence. Here you get maybe its stochastic cousin or something like this. The different lines are for different Rn. Here Rn is 10 something, 10 xn, here it's 30 and so on. You see that there's already no difference between 30 and 50, and we also took 100 and so on. So we have a very, we know where our infinity is, at least for the calculations. Another way to check our solutions, one can show that the equation has invariance, has probably more, but the leading invariants, the three leading invariants which appear in the literature, mainly in work by Peter Janssen in 83, and also repeat similar work in 2003. Every 3 years, 20 years, he visited this problem. Our calculation maintained the first invariant, non-dimensional, of course, by the initial value, very accurately. The third invariant is much more complicated. It also, you see, the first is actually the energy or the wave action. It depends on the values that are equal or not. The third one is much more complicated. It depends on both on R and rho. This we, through our calculation, managed to maintain within 2%. The second invariant is zero, so it's more difficult to say how accurate you are because you have not what to normalize with. The only thing that we can show that when we take Cn 30 and 50, it stays the same. I don't know if this is a small value compared to zero. Everything is large. So. We studied many different cases. I don't go into the whole table. We studied different kinds of spectra, Gaussian, Lorentz square. We studied different type of sidebands, Gaussian, Lorentz square, different deltas. We almost exhausted the possibilities. Of course, there are infinite possibilities, but just to show you another interesting picture. This will be rho as a function of x at r equals 0. And the evolution in time is given by the different lines. The initial condition is given by the solid line here. It's almost horizontal. If we speak about a homogeneous ocean, it would be completely horizontal. We introduced the t equals 0, a slight inhomogeneity, so you see it's not completely. After a t non-dimensional A25, we get into the most inhomogeneous situation. You see, here was around half, it grows almost to 2.5, and here you get very small values. You never get to 0, but very, very small values. Of course, after one recurrent period, you go back to the almost back to the initial condition, and if you follow it one half period further, you go back with the circles to the original line. So we move from an ocean with slight inhomogeneity to situations which are very, very with strong inhomogeneity. Now, we studied the behavior. This is the cross section in the direction of R, in evolution of time. I don't bother you with these details. Let's look at this picture. Here we have the different cases for the different dots that were on the linear stability diagram. To refresh your memory, it goes close enough. To refresh your memory, A1, all the A's, but also A1 and D were in the unstable region. D was a little bit more unstable than A1 with a larger growth rate. And you see that indeed it grows almost to 6, whereas this grows only to 4. There's also a difference in the recurrence period. Here the recurrence period is a little bit larger. These are very similar trends to if one looks at the long time evolution of solutions of the cubic Schrödinger equation, finds very similar trends. These are the stable solutions. They may look like doing something, but look at the range here. This is from 1 to 1.2. This is from 1 to 1.1, whereas this is of the order of 4 and 6. So these stable solutions don't really do much, as we expect. We also studied the influence of taking different spectral shapes, that's not a very excited result. We also studied the influence of taking different disturbances. Here, square disturbance, a larger square disturbance, and here we took the same area as we had here, doing 10 times narrower, but increased, have the same energy. And you get exactly the same evolution. So we can study a lot of technical aspects of this problem. This is the conclusion of the first part of the talk. It's not I'm trying to give you a two for the price of one, because this is not the, what are the temporal conclusions of what we have seen so far. Number one, what I think is most striking result of this work is the recurrence behavior. This finding is very different from the results for homogeneous seeds. People have looked at nonlinear interaction for homogeneous seeds and still do it through the Zakharov equation, to Hasselmann's equation, which are called the kinetic equation in the Russian school. And this is, but there you are in a homogeneous regime, and the results are extremely different. By the way, if I want to solve this solution, this problem, the kinetic equation in one spatial direction has no resonances at all. You can find one resonance, but the coefficient there is zero, so it will give nothing. What is the reason for these big differences, or for this kind of what I call new result? The reason, to my mind, is the following. In the present study, the initial disturbance spectra are profoundly inhomogeneous. I start out with a small, we seed the problem as we wanted, with a small inhomogeneity. We seed the problem with a small profoundly inhomogeneous. So, how? Through the phase relation to the homogeneous spectrum, in contrast with previous studies for which all initial phases were independent and randomly chosen. And this probably makes the big difference. This leaves us with a question. I mean, as far as proposing a problem and finding a solution which is probably correct, we are fine. But what is, can we put any physical significance in this result? I mean, does it really help us to say something about the real ocean? And this brings one attempt that we did to give, of course, a positive answer of this. These are the people which I have cited. We have used this equation, this concept, to study a very important problem these days, which is related to freak waves. Freak waves are waves of exceptional height. If you believe in a random Gaussian sea and so on, you will not get such high waves. I mean, you will get them, but you will have to stay in the storm for a month or for a year. Storms don't last so much. But in reality, we get these waves which are much higher from time to time. They cause damage to ships. They cause, and they were called giant waves, rogue waves, freak waves, just to frighten us dramatically. One of the there are many suggestions of mechanisms how they can be generated and so on, and we don't go now into all this story, but I would like to show you how the situation of sea swell interaction, see the situation of waves which are generated by local wind, waves within a storm. Swell are waves which come from a far distant storm. They are more like a simple sinus wind. So, not always successful. I don't have the touch. I'll show you how we use the Alber equation to study the problem of sea swell interaction for a mechanism of freak waves. The work was done by the same team. I just want to add Odin Gramstad, who is a PhD student in the Department of Mathematics at the University of Oslo, who for certain aspects of the problem joined the forces with us. What is our inhomogeneous disturbance? This is background you already know, because I already told you everything I know about the Alber equation. The situation is like this. We have a random a homogeneous sea, and we have let's say a monochromatic swell which much longer period coming in. The quadratic interaction between these two will generate bound waves. If the typical wave number of the sea is K and the typical wave number of the swell is capital K, it will generate bound waves that will be K plus minus K through the interaction. Because K is a capital K is assumed to be much smaller than little k, these are actually bound waves, but they are not very far from free waves. They are almost free waves. If you check their frequency, you will see that the frequency is very close, of order epsilon close to the frequency of free waves. Now these bound waves, if you calculate them, you'll find that their phases are strongly correlated to the phases of the original sea, which is random, plus the phase of the monochromatic swell, like the sum of the phases or the difference or something like this. So they really can serve as the kind of inhomogeneous, not exactly the same we had before, but very close to the inhomogeneous disturbance that other people took. Also, I want to mention this kind of relation, that the rho at r equals zero is proportional to what people call h is the wave height, and this is the root mean square wave height squared. This is one quantity which represents a complex ocean, if you want to give one number. One can show, and we don't have time to go through the details, I can give you reference later. One can show that the probability of h or wave height is related to the probability of rho at r equals zero. This is the probability density function of rho. Now, our evolution equation enables us to find the probability density function of rho. And since we can get it from there, we will be able to get new information about the probability of different wave heights in the ocean. Again, this is the different cases, different... Just to give you a feeling, the period of the swell we've chosen, 18 seconds, is a very long swell. The peak period of the sea, was about 10 seconds. We also checked 8 and 12. We took the wave amplitude of the swell was mostly, in most cases, 1 meter. The significant wave height, which is another way to talk about the ocean, I can, if I have time, I explain what it is. But taking, this is a very severe storm with 11 meter waves, a significant wave height. This goes to, we already talked about the stability diagram. These are the different cases that we are now talking about. On the stability diagram, these are very similar to what we talked before. This one is stable, we know. This is an interesting one, I'm not going to tell much about it. This leads to complex recurrence. Why? Because the higher harmonic of this is still in the unstable area. If you take twice this distance, you are still in the unstable area. Things here even get, I don't want to say chaotic, I don't want to use this word, because then you ask me what it is and I cannot explain it. Okay. These are the different recurrent of all the examples. Here we have the isolines of the values of rho in the tau x plane for the different cases. This enables us to calculate the probability of rho. We just take small squares here and we can from this calculate the probability of rho. Here you have the probability density function of rho divided by rho of the homogeneous case, and the probability itself, and you see the difference. The in A1 and A2, and in case B and C, all these are unstable cases, but the most unstable I think was A1. I'm not sure now. Rho goes all the way up to almost 5 or something like this. Can get these values. Or here it goes even beyond. So this is the most unstable one, the one. Here, this is less unstable. You only get to 4. This is, you get only to 2. And here we have a much narrower gap. So this will be the most, this one will be the most inhomogeneous case. From this, now that we have the probabilities of F, we can go back and draw the probabilities of H. And this is an interesting curve. I try to explain it. Here you have the probability of H being larger than the value that is written on the horizontal axis. We are starting from HRS, from values which are over HRMS 285, because these values correspond to twice the significant wave height. I stop for a moment and tell you what significant wave height is. When people convey information about the ocean, like in wave forecasting, and they say the waves are going to be between 3 and 4 meters, what do they mean? Each wave has a different height. So they usually, what they are talking about is significant wave height, which is the average, the simple average of one third of the highest third of the waves. If you have 100 waves and you're ranking from the highest, the less high, and so on, and you take the top 33 and make the mathematical average of them, this is significant wave height. Why did people choose this? Maybe for historical reasons, maybe because of properties of our eye. If you look at the sea, we try to focus more on the higher waves. And you'll ask a standard fisherman what the height is, he will tell you something which is not far away from. So, but this is now commonly used in engineering and oceanography and so on. So we start from waves which are at least twice as high than the significant wave height. Namely, if the significant, these are very high waves. if you go here to something like 4, this wave should be, this is already called freak waves. Waves twice as high as the significant wave height are called freak waves. Waves three times as high as the significant wave height are called extremely freak waves. In a Gaussian ocean, you have to stay there forever, and you will not bump into one of them. Look what happened here. For Gaussian ocean, the probability of wave heights goes by Rayleigh distribution. Rayleigh distribution is the black line here. Very little here, 0.003, and going very fast down, nothing here. This is the Rayleigh distribution. If you go up this diagram, these are the cases which are more and more inhomogeneous, according to the order that we had before. And you see that we have here an increase, I don't know how many fold, 100 fold, 2000 fold. Here, the increase is even much more, I just give you a number in a minute. But this gives you the probability picture for freak waves for the different oceanic conditions which I have described in the table. All this diagram is somewhere here. Just here, you don't see it. If you want to see the full picture, I just draw you the Rayleigh distribution and the one for A2, which is the most unstable one, and you see that for very high waves, the A2 takes off and goes above, as we see here. But of course, for small, this has to be compensated. For smaller waves, Rayleigh distribution lies behind, above this distribution. We also compared our results with Monte Carlo simulations, both of a single Schrödinger equation and of a coupled Schrödinger equation. I don't go into the details now. These are the results, evolution results, in calculating through the Monte Carlo simulation for freak waves and for exceptionally high freak waves. And let me summarize. And now it's the real summary of that part. Albert equation was used to study the statistics of freak waves in a unidirectional inhomogeneous sea. The homogeneity arises due to the interaction of the deterministic long swell with the stochastic short length, I mean sea. The probability of freak waves increased 20 times compared to the reference of Rayleigh distribution. As the spectral width of the sea decreased and the amplitude of the swell increased, the probability for exceptionally high freak waves, three times higher than significant wave height, increased 30,000 fold. This number makes them already such waves that you can encounter. You don't want to encounter them. But if the storm lasts a few days, 24, 48, 96 hours, and you are within the storm and you are unlucky, you may hit one of these waves. Results are also confirmed by comparison to Monte Carlo simulation of the Schrödinger equation. And also here, I like always to say thank you to people upon whom I built the foundation of this talk. Of course, the most important one in this respect is Albert's equation, is Albert himself in the original paper. The first part of my talk about the Albert's equation was recently published in a paper in the Journal of Fluid Mechanics. So one wants really to know about the details, can see the details there. The later part about the freak waves was already accepted for publication in Physics of Fluids, and probably will publish either later this year or at the beginning of next year. But if somebody wants, I can I'll be glad to give the whole article. Thank you very much for your patience. Yes, please.
So I'm not an expert on this, but some time ago I read
Okay. I don't know about this paper specifically. I can just add a little bit more information. Freak waves are very popular these days. What does it mean? Funding agencies are willing to support research on freak waves. So there's a lot of research going on right now on freak waves.
Yeah.
Now, they were explained in a handful of different manners, okay? And none of them is wrong. I mean, okay? One of the things was said, okay, let's just forget about non-linearity and look at it as a superposition which occurs in homogeneity and so on. And then you get, this was one school. Another school said, no, they actually occur by non-linearity. A third school talks about the wave current interaction as a major factor to, if you have a situation where you have waves propagating against an opposing current, like the Gulf Stream, or even in Africa you have an Algula something current which is extremely strong, and there you can get an increase in wave height due to the mathematically you get turning points and caustics and various things of this kind, but eventually practically it's they were actually the first freak waves talked about 30 odd years back, at the time by a paper by Roger Smith in Journal of Fluid Mechanics. The paper was called Giant Waves, but he approached them through the wave current interaction. Further question, please.
Can you say what the underlying NLF plus noise, or do you just start with noise and then NLF?
No, the underlying you start with LNS, and you assume a near Gaussian process, nearly Gaussian. So representing what you do. You write the NLS, let's say the unknown is N, and you choose X1 as your spatial coordinate. You take the equation, multiply it by A, the complex conjugate, at X2, and take the ensemble average, and you apply this transformation to the whole equation. You land up then with on the right hand side of the Schoenherr equation, you have a cubic term in A. If you multiply it by another A at a different allocation, you get a fourth order term. This is a fourth order. I think if you want to understand it in the simplest manner, maybe not completely correct, is let's say that this is the spectrum, and let's just pretend that it is made of a lot of spikes, a lot of modes. The spectrum tells us that each mode has a certain amplitude, but does not tell us what is the frequency of this? What is the phase of this mode? Okay? So, one realization of this will be you split it to, let's say, 100 modes, to 100,000 modes, but you still have to get a realization of the ocean surface, you still need to assign a phase to each of these modes. So, you choose the 1,000 phases and you have one realization, but if you make a different choice, you have another realization. Now, and then you can average over this. This is more or less the concept behind it. Now you can go more wild. You can say not that only. Usually people speak about random phases and then they assume that of course they are uniformly distributed between 0 and 2 pi or something like this. But you can go more wild. You can also say that the amplitude or the energy which you get from the energy spectrum, you get the square of the amplitude, maybe is really distributed. So in this way physics come into the problem. Yes, please. I believe the answer is yes.
Have anyone done a comparison of whether or not you're breaking down the approximations you made in using an amplitude equation model? Because when you use something that looks NLF-ish,
yes,
you've been doing an amplitude approximation, which is sort of not going to automatically be respected by very nonlinear things.
Okay. Actually, the question which you are raising now also refers to the original NLS, okay? Now, how far can you... Of course, the NLS, you start at cubic terms, so therefore you throw many things away. And very unstable waves, or waves just about to break, to represent them, you probably need to go very high. So how far can you go with the NLS? That's the question, actually, essentially. Now let me just the epsilon is given by an amplitude of the wave time the wave number, okay? So it's A naught, K naught, if you speak on this case. Here, of course, the A you have to relate to the energy of the narrow spectrum. For water waves, AK is never larger, in theory, the theoretical limit for AK is 0.41 or something like this. You can prove it. You can talk about the highest wave and, okay? Practically, if you measure in the ocean or even in the laboratory, waves don't go beyond 0.3, 0.3. You can push it a little bit if you do a very careful experiment. Later, at the break and so on. So the nice thing about water waves, there is a small parameter. There is a built-in, really small parameter, and it never goes above 0.3. Does it mean that with the cubic Schrödinger equation I can follow the waves up to breaking? Answer is no. But I can get the indication, it goes to breaking. So what exactly is happening the next few seconds, I don't know. For tsunami? Tsunami, different story. I tell you why it's different story. Tsunami, extremely long waves. Yeah, anybody else want it? I don't want, maybe, or we don't, actually there's another talk here going on, no?
Thank you.
Yeah,
shallower.
We speak here about wind waves. Wind waves have a typical length between 100